Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies, a part of the New Books Network. I'm Garrett Brown, the host of the channel. Today, I'll be talking to Tom McLeish about his new book, Faith and Wisdom in Science, published by Oxford University Press. Tom McLeish is professor of physics and former pro vice chancellor for research at Durham University. He studied his first degree and PhD in polymer physics at the University of Cambridge, and in 1987 became a lecturer in physics at the University of Sheffield. In 1993, he took the chair in polymer physics at the University of Leeds. He took his current position in Durham in 2008. He has won several awards for his work on the molecular rheology of polymers, including the Weissenberg Award of the European Society of Rheology in 2007, the Gold Medal of the British Society of Rheology in 2009, and the Bingham Award of the Society of Rheology in 2010. He is also involved in science communication with the public via regular radio, TV, and schools lectures, discussing the issues from the physics of slime to the interaction of faith and science. He is a fellow of the Institute of Physics, the Royal Society of Chemistry, the American Physical Society, and the Royal Society. Tom McLeish, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you, Garrett.
Well, I wonder if you might begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Love to. I was born in Southeast England, early 60s, and that was, of course, the decade of the early space race, the moon landings. I remember in July 1969 being woken up by my parents at, I think, 2:30 in the morning it was, London time, to watch Neil Armstrong step out of the moon. So, but before then, I knew that I was interested in all things natural and the science of the world around me. I think my grandmother was a big influence on me. She, my paternal grandmother, did a botany degree at London University when she was a young woman, and I remember her introducing me to photography. Develop it your own photography, and the magic of seeing the image appear under the developer in the dark room under that red light. Of course, no one will know what we're talking about now because it's all digital. But called photochemistry. And then she also gave me a wonderful present. She gave me, when I was a child, a field microscope, an old brass field microscope that had belonged to her father. It's a Victorian thing, beautiful thing, with on a mahogany box and a brass stand. You could, and I used it to look at insect eyes and flies' wings and pardon me, leaves and a bit of blood I managed to extract painfully from my finger. and this also the intricacy of the tiny world beneath that the microscope revealed. And then my parents kind of gave me a telescope also when I was about 10 or 11, and the rings of Saturn and the stars above. Also great science at school. So I remember always being fascinated to learn more, always knowing that's what I wanted to do.
Excellent. Well, how did you come to study rheology, and what is it?
Well, yes, rheology is, of course, one typewriter keystroke away from theology, as has been pointed out to me many times. Just move that R across to the T. But no, it comes from the Greek word for flow. Rheology is the study of flow and deformation of matter. I became interested in that, funnily enough, leaving school, I wanted to find out how science worked in industry. And those days, there were many companies that would sponsor students who wanted to do engineering. But I knew I wanted to do physics. I knew physics was, I discovered, was the most fundamental of all sciences, according, as far as I could make out, and that's what I wanted to do. But I was fascinated by how this worked in industry, and there was a textile company called Cortels, it doesn't exist anymore, whose research laboratory is right in the middle of England. So I needed to leave home, live in Coventry for a year, met some very different types of people. So from the personal point of view, that year, getting to know a church fellowship, for example, from my own point of view, but also working in an industrial lab, seeing the materials that made man-made fibers manufactured. So these are the polymers, the macromolecules, the giant molecules of the molecular world. If you think of the water molecule as this tiny little boomerang-shaped thing, 10 billion times smaller than an arm span, then the polymers would be, on that scale, giant strings that would cross a room. And a liquid made of these giant strings can be drawn out, of course, into string-like strings themselves, and can be woven into ropes, fibers, drawn out into sheets. But I discovered that very little was known about the underlying science of this stuff in the lab. So I came away from the industrial lab experience having very changed and broadened as a person. I needed my soon to be Cambridge graduate and Southern English corners knocked right off me by the Midlands motorbike driving, beer swilling plant lads who I enjoyed working with very, very much. But I also came away realizing since science needed to be done. And then fast forward a couple of years to my final year at Cambridge. And I remember going to a lecture by Professor Sir Sam Edwards, one of the great 20th century physicists who, as a research student of Julian Schwinger's from Princeton, one of these giants who'd realized that the great quantum mechanical physics of the 20th century, the quantum field theory, tools and sort of thought set could be put to good service in understanding the statistical mechanics of complex materials or the thermodynamics of random materials. And Sam had been working with a delightful Japanese chemical engineer, a theoretical chemical engineer called Masao Doi in Cambridge, those past 2 or 3 years. And they had developed a theory for how these complex molecular string-like gloopy liquids behaved, how we could connect the molecular world into what we see in the macroscopic world. I should say I've always been, I think what it is about science that captured me early is that it, you can think of it as this special sort of sight, seeing down beneath the surface of the material world, and it's what I love to do. Anyway, so Sam got up and said at the end of his lecture, which most of which I didn't understand at that point, well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we have a first theory of viscoelasticity, which describes the rheology, the strange flow of these materials that are both viscous liquids and elastic at the same time. And I realized I was in probably almost a unique position of knowing that industrial laboratories all over the world desperately needed a fundamental science of this rheology, the science of elastic flow, and the fact that I was sitting at the feet of someone who'd just written down the very first theory of all this. So I decided that this is what my PhD had to be at the beginning of something new. So sticky, slimy stuff has been my scientific life since then.
And the stories here also make it into your book. A little bit explaining some of the science and how it illuminates your approach to theology and the Bible. I wonder if you might talk a little bit about how your background in science then led you to write about this about the Bible and also this tension between science and religion.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I think there were two things. Well, one is not at first sight to do with Christian belief or theology at all. It's that as a scientist, I was aware on the inside of just how imaginative and creative and also just sheer hard work science is. You mentioned the story. I tell the story of what happened next with that theory, and it took really 20 years for the global community to accept it, and there was a very, very hard struggle. And I, as you quite rightly point out, I say in the book that new science theories, when they're little babies, are just like babies, all helpless and weak, and can easily be left out in the cold to die, the cold of scientific criticism and hard data they haven't got around to explaining yet. So actually, the owner or the producer, creator of a new scientific theory needs to fall in love with it, really, for the first few years of its life. So that's the illustration there. I became aware that in the public sphere and in the media, this is not how science is understood at all. It's seen rather in many places as an unimaginative, rather methodological, humdrum, geeky, techie, not very creative, and maybe less human than music or the arts or theatre or painting or story or song or dance, one of those things. For me, it's always belonged to that class. So one of the things I wanted to do is to write a book that explained why science is just as deep and just as human as all those other things that make us human. But the other thing is that, so of course, alongside this, I developed a Christian faith from my young adult years, naturally discovered a love of the Bible, also love of talking about the Bible. I love talking about anything. So in particular, I talk about the Bible, and I become, in the Anglican Church in the UK, what we call a lay reader. That's a lay preacher. That involved a theology course, a diploma for about 3 years. And so as a new full professor at Leeds, and back in 1993 or 94, I was invited by the bishop to address the diocesan conference. Very interesting thing they used to do would be to take a cross section of people from the church, so the pastors, lay people, children, young people, older people, families, workers, homekeepers, everybody you could think of, about 200 or 300 out of town, to think through what it means to be a church and what the issues of society are we can address and speak into. And he said, look, you're a professor of physics and you're a lay preacher in one of our parishes. Please come and talk to us about faith and science, because we're all confused. Many people are telling us there's a tension between them, that they're in permanent conflict. How do you resolve this in your mind? And I realized at that point that I needed to do some thinking, because for me, there's never been any conflict or any obvious reason for conflict between the Christian belief and scientific practice. Far from it. I've always seen since I've been a Christian that to be a scientist is to answer God's call on my life. That's what he wants me to be, I believe. So how could there be a conflict? But I realized that there were reasons that other people thought there were. So I had to do some hard work, and that was a long time ago, but it's been 20 years of thinking, reading, talking, listening, trying to understand where people were coming from. One thing I noticed was that very little of the Bible and science discourse is centered around Scripture or drenched in Scripture. So one of the things I wanted to do was to talk just as a scientist, but as a serious reader of the Bible as well. Where it did touch the Bible, it tended to orbit around the first chapter of Genesis, which I think is a rather over-selective and unhelpful thing to do, that there are creation stories, 20 or 30 or more of them, all through the Bible, and there's a rich seam that I wanted to talk about and relate to what we do as scientists, but also how science works in the world. The way I put it is that it seemed to me that society has lost a cultural narrative for science. We don't know what science is for. We've forgotten where it fits into being human, and we don't know what it's there to achieve. It seemed to me that what one needed to do was to move beyond, as it were, negotiating a boundary between science and theology, but actually to think about what science does inside God's kingdom, inside our calling, what science does for the history of fall, salvation, redemption, renewal, resurrection, if you like, so the church can give science a big bear hug and call it its own and receive it as a gift from God. Talk in those sorts of terms. So those are the different strands that got me writing the book.
That's excellent. I mean, one of the things that's so striking about your book is the way in which you read the Bible with the scientific understanding, and that it really has helped you to see the natural wisdom is one thing you call it, but also the attitude of science, or this curiosity about the natural world, that is actually deeply embedded in the Bible. Can you talk a little bit about that, particularly the way in which it appears in some of the less discussed text other than Genesis, but such as Jeremiah and Isaiah and Proverbs?
Yes, love to. Why don't we do that before we build up to what I call the sort of summit of all passages?
Yes.
Yeah, let's do that. I've realized that, of course, you can't look up science in a concordance and then flick through all the places the Bible talks about science. That would be presentist and anachronistic and just the wrong thing to do. But actually, science is a very modern word anyway, and scientist a very modern word. If instead you just stand back from science and ask about what it does, and I think what science does, it helps build, and as I draw out later, in fact go on to heal, the relationship between humans and the natural world that they live in. So if one starts asking about texts that talk about the relation between the human predicament and the natural world in creation, then you find that, as you quite rightly pointed out, the theme is very, very, very rich, particularly within the wisdom books. And in some ways, I think probably if I had my way at ordering the canon, I might have even put the wisdom literature right at the beginning rather than the Pentateuch, but there we are. unorthodox. Anyway, certainly if you're going to start to think about science, and I would say start with the Psalms, with Proverbs, and then go on to Genesis after that. And the reason for that is you realize there's these little creation stories that are rather simpler, but more fundamental than the rather more ornate and developed liturgical form of Genesis 1. Here's an example. If we go to Psalm 33, which is a psalm that begins, as many do, with a sort of musical call to praise, it finishes with what I call an extended affirmation of hope for the nation, for God's chosen nation. But between the call to praise and the affirmation of God's hope for the future, you get a little creation story. Here we go. I'll just read it. Just four lines. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, the starry host by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea into jars. He puts the deep into storehouses. I'd say rather new vocabulary for the creative act, but it becomes very emblematic of creation stories throughout the Psalms and Prophets and Proverbs too, that creation is talked about as the formation of boundaries, the ordering of the material of creation into different phases, the land to one side, the sea on the other. No, he gathers the waters of the sea into jars so that it can't flood back over the land again. The deep below, the deep is put into storehouses so it stays there. And the starry host above. So you have this three-dimensional ordering of the heavens above, the foundations, the earth below, the land and the water separated. And then the second way is that these creation stories operate. It's always within a story, within the history of deliverance, of typically between a despair and hope blend in the past towards healing in some time in the time of vindication to come. So Jeremiah is a wonderful example, because by the time you get to recognize this trope of foundations and heavens, of boundaries, Jeremiah gets to tell the story. But it's when you read Jeremiah at chapter 4, he's warning Israel of the consequences to the physical creation of them turning their back on their creator. And it's like putting the film in backwards. It's like running the movie backwards. Listen to this. You'll hear the same things again. I looked at the earth and it was formless and empty. At the heavens, their light was gone. I looked at the mountains, they were quaking, and the hills were swaying. I looked, there were no people. Every bird in the sky had flown away. I looked, and the fruitful land was a desert. All its towns lay in ruins before the Lord, before his fierce anger. So where the heavens were with a starry host are no more. Where the land was fruitful because of the water irrigating it, it is now dry. And the earth being fixed and established is now shaking. So what Jeremiah does is to run the film backwards as a horrific warning of consequences of godlessness, and but of course you only know that if you know the fundamental creation story and you know that Jeremiah is running it backwards. So we develop that, and the other thing I develop is the observation that wherever human relationship with natural creation is talked about in the Bible, it is always in the context of pain. And you may say, well, come on, science, yeah, you'd be surprised. Scientists, it doesn't get much more painful than doing science. And I have a certain sympathy with that. But interesting, just think about Genesis. No, go to Genesis. Creation story, briars, thorns, pain of childbirth, Proverbs, full of creation stories. That lovely one, it's probably my favourite creation story, of the birth of wisdom in chapter 8 of Proverbs, where wisdom is a little girl, Sophia. Sophie is playing at the Lord's feet, delighting as he throws up sort of sandcastles of mountains and plays with this beautiful, open, creative, fruitful creation. But of course, Proverbs is a very painful book. It's shot through with the pain of wrong turnings, of leading the unwise life. And so forth. So this long biblical story of the creation and nature language of the Bible describing the still chaotic and still painful relationship with creation seems to me to be both very, very authentic, but also deeply intriguing.
I'm curious to know if the pain aspect is what prevents the wisdom literature in the Old Testament from becoming idolatry. You know, it's not as if we see pantheism emerging or, is that why there's always this slight frame shifting away from that and a tendency to see these things as symbols of divine creative power? Or how do you think about those things?
Well, that's a good question. Yes, we'll talk about Job in a minute, I think, and it's true what you say. One of the ways I analyse the framing of our relationship with nature in Job, there are in fact I think six major different alternatives with which our relationship with Job with nature is described. And in fact, the idolatrous worship is actually one. It's one that doesn't make so much sense to us these days. But at one point, Job, in his many speeches in which he insists on his own righteousness, that he hasn't in any moral sense deserved the suffering he's received, says, I never kissed my fingers to the moon. It's when he's being really rather recondite and quiet. As I say, the idea of temptation to kiss our fingers to the moon is perhaps not one that we notice much in our urban sodium lit landscapes. But out in the Middle Eastern desert on the darkest of nights, when a great silver orb hangs against a velvet background, thousands of stars, it's a different thing altogether. So maybe you're right about the pain. I think the other way of thinking about the pain is just the natural consequence of the Jeremiah spoke about. Jeremiah spoke about a sort of future fall, but a fall is something that, in its consequences, is something that, in some sense, of course, happens all the time. There's sin and there's consequences for sin. And if there's anything we have discovered practically about our relationship with nature, like all broken relationships, I mean, you have a tough relationship with someone and it needs mending, chances are that the problems start with ignorance. You don't really know each other very much, very well. And then because you don't know each other, you don't know their motivations, how they're going to work, there's fear. And because there's fear, then there's thirdly this step of harm. Now, our relationship with nature embodies all those three stages. We start off very ignorant of the natural world, and so we're frightened of it. This motivation for doing science, by the way, so that it draws the sting of fear from the natural world, is a very, very old one. One theme of the book, of course, is that what we now call science is the latest chapter of a book that humanity has been writing for many centuries, if not millennia. So where I come from in the northeast of England, I work now at Durham Cathedral, local cathedral at my town where I work, has the tomb of the Venerable Bede, an late 8th and early 9th century holy scholar who wrote a wonderful 8th century science book. And he explains why he's doing this. He says, I'm writing to you, students, about nature so that when the lightning strikes or when the earth shakes, whatever, you won't think that there are evil spirits out there trying to get you, but that this is nature working as nature works, with its own mechanism, its own works that God created for it.
Yes. Well, with that, let's turn to the book of Job, which is really the heart of your argument, which is beautifully articulated. And you also say that it really is at the summit of your look at the way in which the Bible informs this conversation between faith and science. So tell us a little bit about how Job prompted some of this thinking.
Yes. Well, since I first read the book of Job a long time ago, I've wanted to write about it as a scientist. And in some ways, I've written the whole of the Faith and Wisdom in Science book around the book of Job. I think it's the most important nature writing in the whole of the Bible. But of course, people have raised an eyebrow at me when I've said that, because people find it a difficult book. You know, there's Job as a sort of suffering servant of God. He's lost everything, lost his family and wealth and house. He's also lost his health. He's sitting there covered in disgusting boils on a heap of ash and surrounded by three friends who do the right thing for 3 days and keep their mouths shut. And then they make a very bad move and start talking to him about the way that the world works, and that the world hurts you if you do bad things. And that's not, of course, what Job wants to hear. The nature poetry seems to come later, because, of course, one thing that Job wants desperately is for God to answer Job's accusations that he's being treated most unjustly. And for 37 chapters, of course, there's silence, terrible silence, often the experience of the suffering person. And then we're told God speaks from the whirlwind. And what comes then is this extraordinary nature poem. It's known as the Lord's Answer. And every verse is a question. And it's beautiful. It starts with a creation story. Job is asked to stand up. He's taken to the beginnings of creation, and God asks him, where were you when I founded the earth? Tell me, if you have insight, who fixed its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring cord across it? So there we have the ordering trope, the fundamental biblical creation story again. And then God asks Job questions about all the physical world. Where is the realm of the dwelling of light? And as far as darkness, where is its place? Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Where is the realm where heat is created? Where does wind come from? Who cuts a path for the thunderbolt? And then the stars above. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose Orion's belt? Really deep questions. Listen to that. The writer has noticed that some stars are clustered together and others are distributed further apart. What is the force? What is it that binds the tight cluster together? Can you determine the laws of the heavens? So anachronistically, the Lord's answer in Job moves in question form through all those fields of science we now call astronomy, geology, oceanography, zoology, and so forth. Of course, it's it's anachronistic to say so, but nonetheless, I think there is a continuity between those deep and searching ancient questions and the investigations people call science now. But the secondary literature on the Book of Job has been very hard on the Lord's answer. The standard commentary response is to call it no answer at all, but a sort of petulant put-down from a deity that just wants Job to shut up. After all, it doesn't seem to be answering Job's question, which is a moral question around why he's unjustly suffering. God seems to be saying, well, look, yeah, do you know how the stars move? Ah, well, you don't know nothing, do you? So just shut up and be quiet. Actually, Job does shut up and gets quiet at this point. But something I've noticed in reading the whole of the book, including the three cycles of speeches and the earlier material, is that none of the nature image or nature metaphors used in the Lord's answer to Job are in the book for the first time. They've all already occurred in the earlier discourses of the book. And it's possible to take us, a nature trail through Job from the very beginning without leaving the, if you like, the nature trail. So that's what I wanted to do, and to discuss why it is that the tension between order and chaos in the natural world acts as a continuous metaphor in support of the moral argument about order and chaos, and why the Lord's answer is an answer, and why that makes our relationship with the natural world so important.
Yes. You know, it's curious that your science background has really positioned you in a way to see this book with fresh eyes. And I was simply astonished by your interpretation, and it gave a rich, rich new meaning to the book. I'd always appreciated its poetry, but this helped me to see an engagement with the world in a way that I had never done so before.
Well, no, that's really good to say so. And I should say I couldn't be more delighted when people say things like that. And I've had a few Old Testament scholars saying, yes, now this is actually worth thinking about. I should say I'm very, very grateful. I'm not sure he agrees with me, but for the advice and encouragement of a man called David Clines, Sheffield University, now retired, who spent his life with the Book of Job, who calls the book the most intense intellectual and theological book of the Old Testament. He's also produced his own translation of the Hebrew, which he kindly allowed me to quote from in the book. So I've had a lot of help here. But I have noticed, just to perhaps flag out how I draw from the Book of Job this idea that a theology of science can begin here, rooted in the wisdom literature, and talk about our relationship with the physical world as one of the relationships that needs to get healed within the kingdom, is paradoxically in the words of one of Job's friends. It's an interesting book because sometimes the Job's unwise friends are given wise words to say. And at one point, Elihu talks about the day when he will repent, when he will be in fellowship with God once, with Yahweh once more. But he says something else. He says, "You will be in covenant with the stones." And it's a shocking thing to say, because the word for covenant, Berith, really is the Old Testament, the Hebrew word used for that highest of all relationships. It's the word used for the Abrahamic and the Mosaic covenant. It's the same word. And we have it with a stone. It's so scary that it scared some translators off. And people have chickened out and translated this in other ways in the past from time to time. But no, it's really there. And I think that made me smile, because I could see within this book is this vision of a healed relationship in which humankind can have the sort of mutual, deep, under-the-surface knowledge and respect and mutual bond in wisdom with the natural world that we so lack now, and that this is the task in which a Christian framing for science is somehow engaged. This, I think, it has a New Testament resonance too, of course. It's important to look at all this through New Testament lenses, and your listeners will realize I'm already doing that in the words that I choose.
Right, and this is your connection to St. Paul. I had actually never realized the connection that you make between Job and Romans, where St. Paul writes about the groaning of creation. Can you talk a little bit about that and how then you transition into talking about the reconciliation that science can be a part of?
I certainly nod at, of course, the prologue to John's Gospel being a creation story. In fact, it picks up some of the Logos language by the God's word, the word the heavens and earth created that we see in the Psalms. But in Paul as well, creation, the very deeply physical creation, is very, very much to the fore. And you remember what I said about Psalm 33 and the other, the Old Testament creation stories being often bridge passages. It's when you move from current predicament to future hope. It's very often via the contemplation of God's purposes with the physical and natural world. And this is true of perhaps Paul's most sublime part of Romans, maybe our favorite chapters. You know, it's the chapter that begins, therefore there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And that's where he starts, and he gets by the end to there being nothing that can separate us from the love of God, not height nor depth nor storm. Anything can separate from the love of God. Between that beginning point and the end point where Paul gets to in Romans 8 is this extraordinary passage about all creation groaning until the children of God be revealed. It also talks, so there's the pain again, it's the pain of childbirth. There's a new creation being born here, and it's a deeply relational issue between the whole of creation and the children of God. So moving on in Paul to his correspondence to the Corinthians, I'm so impressed by Paul as the master of the soundbite. I'm sure if we bumped into St. Paul in the Agora or in the Corinth market square as a Hellenistic Jew or a well-educated Greek and asked him, Paul, in the AD 60s or so, what is this? Oh, it's new teaching. What are you talking about? It makes no sense to me, this new way. I don't think he'd have said, well, do you remember Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob straight away? Or let me take you back to Moses. Not straight away. I'm not even sure he'd have told us about Jesus of Nazareth straight away, because, of course, those stories weren't well known in the ancient world at that time beyond the small Christian communities. He'd have said, I'll tell you what it's all about. It's about the healing of broken relationships. Because we all know those, we all know about those, we all need know about the need to be healed. And that's the way he put it, the way he said it, of course, in 2 Corinthians, was we have the ministry of reconciliation. So that's the theology in which I think our relationship with the natural world belongs, and I think that's where science belongs. It belongs as the toolkit within the kingdom to participate in the healing of that most humble of relationships. It's not the great ones of nation and nation or people and people or within families, but it's a humble one between humankind and the natural world. Big resonances, by the way, fast forwarding two millennia to the 20th century. Even a humanitarian commentator or literary critic like George Steiner said in this context, actually, the purpose of art was to waken, he called it, into some measure of commensurability, the inhuman otherness of matter. Hannah Arendt says similar things. So we have even 20th century philosophers and commentators talking about the human need for a bridge to be built between the part of nature which is human, namely us, and the inhuman otherness of everything else. So extraordinarily, these 20th century philosophical ideas dovetail for me beautifully in the story we've been telling from Old Testament wisdom literature into St. Paul.
Out of this, you know, there are a number of consequences, I think, for the way in which we teach and share science in public, but also how we celebrate science in churches, which I think churches have not been, that has not been their strong suit. So what are the implications of some of these things that you've been arguing both about the Bible and the way that science is motivated by this profound curiosity of our natural world.
Well, absolutely, Gary. Thank you very much. Well, of course, there are many, and I should spend a chapter. Each of these could be a book on its own, couldn't it? I do hope some of our colleagues might write some of them and put them into practice. But here are a few ideas. So the first thing is, of course, is to let our scientific discoveries and knowledge inform our preaching and our worship, not as something which needs to be sort of negotiated, some sort of negotiable truce with, as the sort of materialist atheists would have it, but as something that we can grasp as God's gift in thankfulness. That's the first thing. What about celebrating just as much those young people from our churches who leave and go off to do science and engineering degrees as those who leave and work for mission stations or whatever? I remember, at church, our experience is folks going off to a full-time Christian work up at the front of church, have a prayer letter, so forth. Well, if we do it with them, and I'm not denigrating that at all, fantastic stuff, how wonderful that they're doing that, but how just as wonderful that some of our other young Christian people have a calling to go and read physics or chemistry, and let's celebrate them in the same way. Wouldn't that be a fabulous symbol? I know some churches actually in the northern city of York, though I come from, who recently got together and decided to launch a science festival. In fact, it was an ecumenical project. It involved the Baptists, the Anglicans, and the Methodists in one local region of town. Just launched a local science festival, because it would enrich the people who live there. And they had a little exhibition of science-related stuff people had in their attics. There were some lectures and talks given by local people who worked at the university. It was a fabulous thing to do. It wasn't particularly linked at a mission, but it's one of those things that wove the church into the cultural fabric of the community, which I'm sure you'll know is one of those sort of pre-missional activities that's so important, part of being salt and light. And then, of course, there is, thirdly, the area of mission itself. So many of our young people, and actually not so young people for that matter, so sadly, have fixed in their minds that you cannot be a Christian and believe in science for all sorts of strange reasons. So one thing we can do is to make sure that in our missions, we visibly celebrate and do the apologetic stuff around that. But yeah, going on into the media, I think with a theologically equipped, we can help the society at large talk much more sensibly about science. One thing I point out in the book is how bad we are at having adult conversations about difficult science and technology topics. I think this is true in the US as well as it is in the UK. You know the topics I mean, fracking or GM or climate change or nanotechnology, geoengineering, all of these things. People just tend to argue about them. We don't tend to move forward together. But I think the church can be really very effective, armed with a purpose for science. Sure, theology is really about the only discipline, and belief is really the only worldview that still manages intellectually to grasp what the authentic talk about purpose might be. That's the context in which we can talk about these things. So there's a political, educational, media, worship, mission, you name it. I think this stuff goes everywhere. Oh, I've even thought of one other thing. When people are hurt, we give them healing. We sometimes call it therapy. We've discovered all sorts of therapies that help people. Music therapy, dance therapy, art therapy. And I've talked to a number of practitioners of these fields, and I think what they do is quite wonderful. I know this sounds kind of weird, but if science is about restoring our broken relationship with the inhuman world around us, might not some hurt people need something we could only call science therapy? Now, I know your listeners will be thinking, wait a minute, it was science that drove me mad in the first place. It's not going to create a therapy for me. But, you know, within this theological lens, maybe we can do this. Obviously, it won't be book learning or rote learning or doing math questions. It'll be playful. It'll be restorative. But that's another long-term project that this is leading me to that I'd love to play with myself.
Yes, so I know I've taken up a lot of your time, but tell me a little bit more about what you're working on now.
Oh, yes, well, thanks. Briefly, so I've got fascinated by the physics of protein molecules. I'm actually working with biologists in an interdisciplinary project funnily enough, it's got this order and chaos theme that comes out of the book. Molecular matter at the nanoscale at room temperature is under constant vibration and random chaotic motion, and yet biology manages to bring order out of this, and I'm fascinated by that. So I'm working on the way that proteins signal through their thermal noise. Actually, I've got a project on science history too. This is really wild, my favourite interdisciplinary project. I'm working with some Durham medieval historians working at some of the science of the High Middle Ages. It works really well because if anyone's good enough at Latin and medieval philosophy to understand what the texts are saying, they probably gave up science when they were about 13 years old, and that's what this is coming to help read the mathematics there. So we're having fun there too. And then I'm thinking early days, but thinking towards another book, which will be looking at how science is like poetry and art and music, just to work out one of these consequences of faith and wisdom, the science is deeply human story.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. We'll have to have you back on the show when that follow-up book is published.
Well, I'd love to.
You know, just as a way of concluding, you know, I think about science really beginning and ending in wonder, and I wonder if you might comment on that generally, and is that the place where the biblical writers began, and it's also the way in which scientists now, as they investigate nature and medicine, that we also step back as we learn about the new discoveries in science or see images from Hubble or whatnot. You know, is this where it also ends and propels us forward?
It's wonder is in the middle there somewhere, but I'm not sure I'd say agree with you that it's the beginning or the end. It's usually used that way, but I think one of the things I'm trying to take us on is to say it's actually much, much more than wonder. It actually begins with creation. It perhaps goes through wonder, but it ends with recreation and reimagining the universe. Kepler, that great Renaissance astronomer, talked about knowing God's mind after him. Gosh, that sounds as if we're claiming too much, doesn't it? But actually, there's a most wonderful passage in the Book of Job that's called the Hymn to Wisdom, we haven't talked about yet, it's very amusing. It talks about where wisdom can be found, and there's a sort of search underground for the miner, and it's not under the ground, and it's not under the sea, and the depths haven't heard of it. But then God is described as seeing into the creation and measuring the waters by weight and measure, and that sort of special seeing into creation in which we are invited to participate. So, yes, it's wonder, but it's also about participating with God in the reimagining and recreation of the world. It's about calling. It's about commission, too.
Well, I certainly wish we had more time to explore these topics in greater depth, but I really appreciate the time that you've had. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
It's been a real pleasure for me, too. Thanks, Garrett, very much indeed.
All right. Thank you. That concludes my conversation with Tom McLeish, author of Faith and Wisdom in Science, published by Oxford University Press. I hope you've enjoyed today's program, and we'll listen again to another program on New Books in Biblical Studies.